This is the Canadian Mountain Podcast, brought to you by the Canadian Mountain Network. This is a special episode of the Canadian Mountain Podcast in honor of International Mountain Day. This episode was live streamed on December 11th, 2017 at the University of Alberta Mountain Festival in Edmonton.
Hello and welcome to the Canadian Mountain Network's International Mountain Day live stream. It's our second year coming to you live from the University of Alberta in Edmonton. I'm Meg Wilcox, and for the next hour, I'll be connecting you to some of the mountain communities that are celebrating International Mountain Day. We'll be going up to Jasper, over to Victoria, we'll be down to Crow's Nest Pass, and we'll also be checking in on some mountain webcams, just like you saw in Marmot, to see what's happening at a higher altitude. It was in 2003 that the United Nations first declared International Mountain Day, and ever since, on December 11th, today, communities around the world are coming together to celebrate and to bring awareness to the world's mountain environments and the people and cultures that inhabit them. And you'll be getting a bit of a taste of that today. And as you saw at that first webcam there from Marmot, that's where we're heading first today on the live stream. We're heading to Jasper. And Aaron Reed is joining us at Marmot Basin. Hi, Aaron. How are you doing?
Hi, Meg. I'm really well. And how are you?
I'm doing great. Tell us where you are. It looks a little busy behind you there.
Yeah, I'm currently standing on the Caribou Deck in the lower chalet at Marmot Basin. It's a beautiful day here today. The sun is shining. It's nice and warm, much different to last year. Absolutely beautiful up here today.
And you were saying sunny, warm. It seems like a decent number of people just coming behind you on the hill. It's been pretty busy so far.
Yeah, it's a great day for a Monday. Everyone's out enjoying the sunshine and the fantastic conditions we have up here. We've had a lot of early season snow this year, over 2 meters so far, with a base of over 80 centimeters as well. So really great conditions for the start of the season. And yeah, we're certainly enjoying this warmer weather for mid-December. It's about, I'd say about -10 degrees right now up here on the deck. And yeah, just beautiful, enjoying the sunshine. As you can see, there's people beside me here and around the corner, enjoying their lunches on the deck here. And yeah, really gorgeous bluebird day.
Now, you mentioned there's been a lot of snow this season. Can you give an explanation? Because it has been a lot of snow that you guys have seen so far.
Absolutely. A lot of snow, you know, it's beating our 5 and 8 and 10 year records, or average records for sure. It started with a big dump at the end of September. That sort of melted off a little bit, and we got a lot more snow in October than we usually would. We had over a meter of snow when we started the season on November 10th. And that's one of our earliest openings, you know, in the record books. I think there might be one season where we've opened one day earlier, but really, you know, great snow conditions, lots of wonderful skiing. As you can see, people coming down the mountain behind me here, great coverage around the mountain, and we're very excited that we've started so well.
So you've started well, there's tons of snow. I also understand there's 45 new acres of ski terrain this year too. Tell me about that.
So we've opened an area called Tres Hombres. This is an area that's always been part of our leasehold, but we haven't opened it to the public before. So Marmot Basin has just got a lot bigger. We've got 5 new runs in that area, really big, steep, advanced terrain. It is our longest uninterrupted fall line at Marmot Basin. So if you're an advanced to expert skier, this is an area that you've really got to get in and see for yourself. It's fantastic skiing and riding in there.
And so you've got new ski terrain, you have a ton of snow, as you mentioned, it's a bluebird day right now. It looks like it's going to be a great season, but what are you looking forward to most about it?
Oh, I don't know. I love everything as a part of the season. you know, I always enjoy those powder days. We've been very, very lucky that we've had quite a few of them already this season. We'll certainly be excited to have more of them as we move into the season. In fact, I can see a little bit of snow on the forecast for this coming sort of Thursday, Friday of the week. So that's very exciting. I think, you know, just getting out, enjoying the mountains, being part of the mountain community, enjoying the town of Jasper. You know, it's different. You get to escape the city. You get to come out here, get that sense of freedom as you're on your board or on your skis and you're skiing around on the terrain. And I think it's really great because everyone can enjoy it, no matter what level you are. Marmot Basin has something for everyone, whether you're a beginner skier, never done it before, fantastic lesson programs down here. We've also got, you know, great different terrain for those intermediates, advanced expert skiers and riders. The intermediates will really enjoy the long carving groomers. And obviously for those advanced and experts, getting into Tres Hombres for the very first time will be fantastic. And enjoying places like Eagle East and the Knob as well. So Eagle East opened this week or last week, and some fantastic skiing and riding in there as well.
Wow. Well, thank you so much, Erin. I'm feeling like a bit of a chump for being indoors when it looks so beautiful right now at Marmot.
Oh, yeah. You've got to come out here. It's really fantastic. Yeah.
Great. Well, have a good day and enjoy that sunshine.
Thank you very much. And happy International Mountain Day.
Thank you. You as well. That's Erin Reed.
Bye.
And she's at Marmot Basin, just outside of Jasper in Alberta. We're going to be talking to our next guest, Mary Sanseverino. So as we all know, one of the best ways to celebrate mountains is through photography. And the Mountain Legacy Project, it takes it to a whole other level. So here's a video that they put together that helps explain their work. So we have mountain peaks, helicopter rides, panoramic photos. It's a pretty sweet gig. And for Mary Sanseverino, it's a pretty much typical day on the job when she's out in the mountains. She's the research associate with the Mountain Legacy Project. She's also a professor emerita at the University of Victoria. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Megan. How are you?
I'm doing very well. And yourself?
Not too badly. Happy International Mountain Day.
Yeah, likewise. So where are we catching up with you right now?
Well, you're catching up with me right now at University Hut number 4, or University House number 4. It's our little cabin in the woods on the campus at the University of Victoria. It's a beautiful day here.
And I was going to say, must be behind a poster right now, because a beautiful view behind you as well.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, this is Mount Assiniboine, one of the images that we re-photographed in 2010 and in just redid this last summer in 2017. And it's a duplicate of an image by Arthur Wheeler from 1913.
Wow. So for you working with the Mountain Legacy Project, as someone who's never been introduced to this before, what's your quick explanation or your elevator pitch?
Elevator pitch. Imagine that it's Canada back just before Canada became a country. So you've got to make some maps. You've got a country, got to make some maps. And so map making progresses. Everything's tickety-boo until we hit the mountains. And at the mountains, traditional techniques for surveying were not very effective. They were very expensive, really difficult to do. So a new technique was developed, a made-in-Canada technique called phototopography. And this saw surveyors from about 1888, actually our earliest images from 1861, but the majority of our images, 1888 to the mid-1950s, and they were taken primarily by surveyors standing on top of mountain peaks using the camera, that newfangled thing in the 1880s, pretty new, called the camera, to help make maps. We figure out where these surveyors stood. We go back to the same spot that the surveyors stood, retake their photo, digitize the historic image, digitize the modern image, and then overlay the two and make them available for mountain researchers of all stripes to use for their work. And we do a little bit of our own research too.
So you have all of these old photos from those early days of photography and the exploration of the mountains with the Development West. How did you find all these photos?
Well, it first came about with Dr. Eric Higgs and Dr. Janine Remtula. They were working away. Janine was a graduate student at the time. Eric was associated with the University of Alberta, and they're working in Jasper. And the two of them are essentially asking questions the way one does. And the question was, I wonder what the landscape in the Athabasca Valley around Jasper looked like 100 years ago. I wonder how it's changed. And they were guided to a box of old photos taken in 1915 by Morrison Parsons Bridgeland. And they looked at them and they went, wow, I know where this particular one is taken from. And it was just above the power dam at in Jasper. And off they went, took a photo, and the Mountain Legacy Project, it wasn't called that back then, but the Mountain Legacy Project was born. And we realized at that point that we had a real treasure trove of images and just a legacy, if you will, to work with on our hands.
And you have so many images now, and I wanted to ask you, from being able to compare today and past images, what are some of the trends that you're seeing? And we do have some images that we'll be able to pull up here to show our viewers as well.
Well, of course, one of the big trends, obviously, is going to be disappearing ice. So you can see glacial retreat writ large on the landscape. That's really noticeable. More subtle, but still pretty notable, is so we have that alpine ecotone, that area around the trees just creeping up the mountains. There's indications, of course, that's a really complex process as to how that happened, but one of the drivers is a slightly warmer climate. So warming world is one of the drivers that has that ecotone creep, so you can see that. You can see infill. That's a really amazing thing to look at. You look down in some of these valleys, on some of these slopes, and you go, my gosh, there were hardly any trees here 100 years ago, or there were fewer trees, a lot fewer trees 100 years ago. Now they've infilled. Probably that is because we have suppressed or excluded fire from landscapes where fire was a big shaper of the landscape. And of course, we can see cultural and built history. We can see evidence of First Nations people on the land. We can see evidence of old railroads. We can see evidence of the direct hand of man on the landscape and how that's changed. So there's lots there to take a look at.
And I'm wondering if we can put up the picture right now comparing the Athabasca Glacier so people can get an idea of the images and sort of what the comparison is. And Mary, if you want to explain a bit the difference that can be seen.
Sure. So the historic image was taken, actually this is a panorama of three or four images. I can't remember how many I popped in there, but this is a panorama of images taken in 1917 by Arthur Wheeler as part of the Interprovincial Boundary Survey, so setting the boundary between Alberta and British Columbia. And we're looking historically, the historic image is the black and white one, and it looks down at this massive glacier, and that is the Athabasca Glacier filling the valley that today has the Banff Jasper Highway on it. So if we turn to look now at the modern retake, that was shot in 2011, and it was shot from this exact same spot. You can tell if you kind of look at the rocks in the lower right-hand corner, they're still in the same spot. So it's from exactly the same spot, and we see obviously a lot of glacial recession. But we also see a couple of other interesting things. In the mid right hand of the image, there's a chunk of forest, and that same forest was there in 1917 as today. And it doesn't look like, maybe it's gotten a little tiny bit more dense, a tiny bit more infilled, but boy, if I was an ecologist looking for an interesting site to take a look at how trees withstand the rigors of those tough alpine ecosystems, I think maybe I'd go and poke my nose in over on that side to see. So that's just a quick down and dirty non-specialist look at what those two images can show us.
And I understand that, I mean, there's so many uses for these photos and the comparisons, but one of the other things is that it's being used for is in terms of wildfire sort of analysis and suppression techniques. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Well, one of the things that forest fire specialists look to do is they look to try and figure out what is the forest fire regime in a given area. And for the regime, that's the pattern of the fire, the intensity of the fire, the history of fires on the landscape. For that sort of thing, wildfire specialists need to look back in history. They need to know a little bit of the history. And so these pairs can help give a look back. You can see where old fire evidence is on the landscape, and then compare that with the modern. Maybe I would go and take a look. Maybe that's a place to think about a controlled burn. Maybe that's a place to go and look to see, well, gee, is there anything? Are there any geological features? Are there any features that cause this to burn but not the next spot? If you have the images of King Creek, that's a really excellent example of fire on the landscape.
And so for people who are hearing about this for the first time now, hearing a bit about the utility of these photos, or maybe how they could contribute to it, how can they get involved?
Well, the best thing to do is to head over to the Mountain Legacy website. So you can just pop Mountain Legacy in your browser, and you'll be taken to our main website. And if you want to just dive right smack dab into the images and get started looking around, you can go explore Mountain Legacy, and poof, you'll be right there.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Mary. And I was just wondering, would you be able to share with us, I don't know if you can turn your camera and just sort of show us a little bit the office space that you guys are in right now.
My pleasure. Yeah. So we're here in coastal. Get a view out there.
Oh, wow. What a backyard.
So this, yeah. So that, sadly, we did not get any barred owls giving us a call today.
Aww.
But that's our regular view out. We're tucked into a bit of a coastal rainforest, temperate rainforest here. And we've got gary oak trees, and that's a big, huge Doug fir right out in front. So it's a great place to work.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for checking in with us, Mary, sharing your little corner where you guys are doing your mountain research, and a very happy International Mountain Day to you.
The same back at you.
That's Mary Sanseverino, and she's with the Mountain Legacy Project. She's based in Victoria, BC. Well, let's throw to another webcam. We can never get enough mountains today. And right now, the one we're going to be seeing, or we see right now, is at Norquay. So Norquay in Banff National Park, not too far from the Banff town site, which is currently -5 degrees in Banff. So not too chilly, nice and sunny today. And that's in Banff National Park, the view of the Cascade Cam. And right there, we are seeing another cam, and that one I am looking at one of the provincial parks. It is also looking sunny and beautiful. We'll just keep putting up photos of mountains and it'll look fantastic. And just a reminder, you're probably online because this is an online live stream. If you want to send or put out any photos of where you live in mountain regions, your favorite memories in mountain regions, the hashtag is MountainsMatterCA. And if you want to get any more information on the live stream or anything else, you might be watching us on Facebook, you can head to internationalmountainday.ca, and that's where you can connect with the Canadian Mountain Network and find other information about events that the Mountain Network is putting on for International Mountain Day as well. Our next stop is heading north now from Victoria, BC, about 15 hours north to Tumbler Ridge. The Global UNESCO Geopark is in British Columbia, and they've also been celebrating International Mountain Day all weekend. And it was Jenna and Sarah from the Geopark that sent us this video update to show what they've been up to.
Hey everybody, it's Sarah
and Jenna
from the Tumbler Ridge UNESCO Global Geopark. We're so excited to be part of the Canadian Mountain Network and celebrate International Mountain Day with our whole week-long festival. We started our festival on Thursday.
Yes, we got a presentation from our local geologist, Kevin Sharman, and he talked about the mountain ranges in our area and how significant they are to us. And then we followed it up with our presentation on Saturday.
That's right. So on Saturday, we heard from our local Tumbler Ridge Search and Rescue Team. They spoke about mountain preparedness and avalanche response in our mountains. And then Sunday was a lot of fun.
Paint and wine night. Everybody likes that mountain theme. So everybody got to do a painting of one of the mountain ranges in Tumbler Ridge.
And then tonight is our flagship item on our schedule. So tonight we've got Dr. Stephen Johnston from the University of Alberta. He's coming to talk about back in the 80s when he actually mapped the geological formations of Canuso Falls. And for those of you who don't know, Canuso Falls is our most iconic waterfall in the geopark. So the water cascades over the Murray River, 60-meter drop. It's over 100 meters wide. It's just breathtaking. And so we're standing here also in front of our Canadian Mountain Artwork Contest. So we had people from the community of Tumbler Ridge all submit their entries. And when will we hear who the winner was?
We'll hear that tonight, actually.
Okay, great. So the Tumbler Ridge Arts Council has helped out with a number of the events. We've had some support from Wild River Adventure Tours in promoting the heli snowshoe events that they do in our southern mountains, and with lots of support from our community hosting things at the community center here and at our local visitor center. So we're so excited to be a part of this and celebrate the importance of mountains in our community and around the world.
Hey, happy International Mountain Day.
Take care. Bye-bye.
That was Sarah and Jenna at the Tumbler Ridge Global UNESCO Geopark in BC. And that's actually what we were seeing at the webcam ahead of time, the Canuso Falls that they were mentioning. So a very breathtaking view and a beautiful day right now in Tumbler Ridge. Currently 6 degrees up in Tumbler Ridge, nice and sunny. And we'll head up to another webcam. So there's Sunshine Village, so also not too far from Banff and based in Banff National Park. A nice, beautiful, sunny day there for those that are out enjoying the snow. We can see there the current weather, 14 degrees. Oh, that's Fahrenheit. Fahrenheit is no good for us. But it is -5 in Banff, so probably a little chillier up right now at Sunshine Village. Actually, I had it pulled up. -6. Yeah, just a little bit chillier in Sunshine Village. And that's out at Panorama. Also a beautiful day. Look at that range in the background. And, you know, what a better way to celebrate International Mountain Day than by looking at mountains in our areas. And our next guest, he's in Saskatoon. And I'll admit, we don't normally think of Saskatoon when we think of mountains. But Steve Mamet's research takes him to Churchill and to the Mackenzie Mountains. And he's a research associate with the University of Saskatchewan's Department of Soil Science. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Megan. How are you?
Great. Nice poster.
Oh, thanks. I randomly got it in the mail. Who'd have thunk? It just seemed to work out for today.
Wonderful. So tell us a bit about your research and what you do.
Okay. So I'm, you know, as a researcher, I wear many hats, but if I had to generalize for today, I'd call myself a biogeographer. And I'm really interested in plant dynamics along environmental gradients. So a great place to find environmental gradients is to go up north where things get colder and colder, or go further up into the mountains. So the main focus of my research is on tree line and permafrost and interactions between the two. So I've been working up in Churchill for the last 14 years now, and up in the Mackenzie Mountains for 11 years.
And so the work that you're doing there, I mean, they're two different regions, and you're seeing how the same phenomenon's affecting these different regions differently. Tell me what it's like and what you're seeing, what's happening in the Mackenzie Mountains.
So in the Mackenzie Mountains, like a lot of tree lines across the circumboreal, you sort of expect to have this united front of trees moving northward or further upslope, but there's actually a lot of variability in that. The Mackenzies is no exception. So my PhD work up there, I did an observational study looking at the tree line population. So we cored the trees, we looked at what the ages were and how they changed through time. We found that up until the 1950s and prior to the 1980s, we had trees moving further upslope and further north in the area. And it's virtually stopped for the conifer trees, the fir trees up there. While deciduous trees have started to work their way up the road. So what we think is going on there is that the timing of the trees stopping their sort of movement into the area has coincided with the establishment and increased growth of a lot of shrubs. So it's almost like something else has sort of taken up the real estate before the trees have had a chance to get in there. So up to the mid 20th century, we had trees moving further north, but now it's largely stagnated for the key player trees up there, the fir trees.
And what exactly does that mean for the region if these shrubs are moving in where trees would normally have been moving in as temperatures changed?
Yeah, it means the potential for a lot of other changes. So we actually expected that, so we wanted to get at some of the mechanisms that are actually, that shrubs influence tree establishment in the area. And as the shrubs move up slope, they actually allow things that eat seeds to move up slope as well. So even if a seed does get to a nice portion of habitat that it could actually grow, it's probably going to get eaten before it even has a chance to survive. And so that's for the trees. For the permafrost, we find that the shrubs, because they trap snow in the wintertime, and snow is an insulator, you get warmer temperatures. And so we actually have thicker active layers. So that's the maximum depth of thaw that forms each year. And so we get thicker active layers, so thicker areas of thaw in the permafrost, but we find that it's actually a lot more stable in these areas where we have shrubs. Compared to the areas where there aren't shrubs, we find that because we've been recording thaw depth for the last nearly 30 years, we can see a nice trend as they're getting thicker, but they're getting thicker faster in the areas without shrubs. So there's some sort of stabilizing effects of shrubs in one sense. And I'll chime in on another area that would be of interest to people, I think, is that as the shrubs move in, they outcompete some of the ground vegetation like lichens. And lichens are a big food source for the caribou up there. So as you get these shrubs covering up these areas, essentially covering the buffet that the caribou would be using. And so that's could be one of the reasons why we're actually seeing less caribou up there in recent years.
Wow, so widespread effects with everything that you guys are finding in terms of those changes. I wanted to ask you about the teams that you work with too, because you're a researcher, but you also work with citizen scientists through a group called Earthwatch International. And I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about that program and the type of work that these volunteers do with you.
Oh, definitely. So it just so happens, in addition to having this poster up, I shamelessly wore this t-shirt today. So Earthwatch International has been around for the last 45-ish years. They started in the 1970s, and they're the largest environmental charity out there. So what they do is they search out funds and essentially people to support long-term environmental research. So I've been working with them. Our project has been associated with them since the early 2000s, but I've been working with Earthwatch since 2003. And so what they do is they'll, in addition to providing funding, they provide, they collect people that are interested in going on what we call a working vacation, and they get to go to places where they've never been before. And there's Earthwatch projects all around the globe. And they'll come up with me and basically get to live 10 days in the life of a field researcher. So we're on the ground for 10 days each year, or 10 days each trip. And they'll help me collect a lot of measurements at a lot of different sites so we can get that replication that we need to have a good idea of what the conditions are. And then also collect those data in a very short period of time. So that we know that the seasons change very quickly, and we'd like to get a snapshot at the same time each year and collect these long-term records so that we're able to get sort of a baseline to compare the changes that we're seeing recently to some sort of baseline. So basically we need to know where we've been to know where we're going. And it wouldn't be possible to collect such a breadth and depth of information if we didn't have these, sometimes called sub-zero heroes, but these citizen scientists that come up and help us collect those data. And then the added bonus of that is that it's great for instantaneous outreach. So you don't need to wait for a paper to be published or say for the media to get a hold of, you know, some of your work. People can come up and they see the data being collected, and we do some analyses right on site, and they get to see these changes for themselves. So it's not sort of like a nebulous change that's happening as they read a paper and, oh, something's happening in the north. They're actually there and seeing it and measuring it, which is, I think, going to be very crucial moving forward with environmental monitoring studies, is that outreach.
And so I know that there's another expedition that's being planned in the near future that people can apply for. Tell me more about that.
Oh, definitely. So we do have trips to Churchill, but the one that I'm really plugging our recruit button for is every August we go to the Mackenzie Mountains. And we spend 10 days there, and we measure permafrost characteristics, download weather stations, and also collect data for our experimental study called the Global Tree Line Range Expansion Experiment, which you can Google and find the website. And yeah, if you're interested in joining, then you can have a look at the details. Of another shameless plug here. I don't know if my screen is tiny. It just looks like chicken scratches. But if you can see it, you can go to earthwatch.com and look up climate change in the Mackenzie Mountains, and you'll find more information on how you can get involved. And I would highly recommend it, because it's one of the most beautiful places I've ever been to, in addition to being really interesting scientifically.
Well, it's always nice when it's both, right?
Oh, yeah. I wouldn't have it any other way.
Is there a particular memory or story or a moment in the field that kind of sticks with you from your research?
Yeah, I could think of a lot of moments that have been quite don't know, entertaining or definitely memorable. And I actually had to think outside my research to get one that would be a little more crowd friendly. So in addition to working in the north and in the mountains, when I lived in Alberta, I was an avid backcountry skier. And so we had tried to do this epic ski trip called the Great Divide Traverse, where we ski from Jasper to Lake Louise. And we made it to the first of many ice fields called the Hooker Ice Field. And we got stuck up there for a while, and it was wet out conditions and quite awful. And while I was on this trip, I learned two things about fun in the backcountry. I learned that there's three types of fun. There's type one fun, which is fun as you're doing it. There's type two fun, that it's fun as soon as you stop doing it. And then there's type three fun, that maybe after several months go by and some of the memories have faded, then those memories become fun again. And I also learned that there's something called sidekick syndrome. And what that is where anything bad that happens will happen to one person, that they just sort of be this lightning rod. And I'll just tell a quick story of one of the ways I learned that was, so we had to have 10 days worth of food on our back as we were skiing in between these caches, and tried to ski through, and breaking trail through snow with basically 100 pounds on your back is quite difficult. And I fell down a lot. And at one point I actually tried to step over a fallen tree, tripped and fell and slid down a slope head first into a stream. And it actually could have been a lot more serious than it was, because trying to get your backpack off with skis on, it's not that easy. But no, not at all. And so the long and short of it is that I got wet. My avalanche shovel fell out of my bag and washed away. And I had very cleverly, put my lunch in a Ziploc bag so it wouldn't get wet, just in case something weird like that happened. But of course, I didn't seal it. So my lunch was just a bag of
soggy food.
Soggy stuff. Yeah. And that's just one of the many things that helped me. These more experienced people I was skiing with, they let me know that I had a very severe case of sidekick syndrome. So that's, I don't know if that's a good story or not, but it's definitely a story that comes to mind when I'm thinking of my time spent in the mountains. And now that would definitely be type three fun, because I look back with such fondness on that trip, but at the time, not at all.
That's fair. And I mean, in terms of your research, part of the reason that you took on the Mackenzie Mountain Research Project was that your thesis supervisor had been doing that work and he sort of bequeathed it to you. So I'm now curious, as you've been in on this for a while now and you're continuing your work in the Mackenzie Mountains, when you see yourself handing off this research down the line, what's your hope for it? Where do you hope it'll be, or what do you hope you can hand off to the next generation of researchers?
Oh, that would be the dream. Well, this long-term environmental monitoring is really, in a lot of ways, undervalued and underfunded, because if you're a funding agency, you want to see results very quick. And it's sort of hard to get that when you're looking at something like climate change that changes over decades to centuries. So I would hope to keep the work going, because some of the things we found, we wouldn't have been able to find if we hadn't had this long-term record that we've been collecting since the 1990s. So I do have a little bit of a fantasy of having gray hair, and maybe there'll be more of it for some reason once I reach my late 60s and handed it off to some young whippersnapper that's got great visions of where to take the research in the future. So that would be my hope. But in the meantime, I'd hope that the work we're doing, we're publishing, and we're also working with various different agencies to make sure that these data aren't just collected and mothballed and therefore sort of ivory tower work, but that they actually have real world and applied uses for, if you're interested in monitoring animal populations or vegetation monitoring, we'd hope that the work we're doing is going to contribute something to that as well. So the plan is the long game, but we'll see what happens.
That's fair. Well, thank you so much, Steve, for joining us and for sharing a bit of your research and your from your corners, I guess we could say, of Canada where you're doing your work.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
That's Steve Mamet, and he is a research associate with the University of Saskatchewan. He's based in Saskatoon. Let's head to another webcam and check a look at the snow levels right now in Glacier National Park. As we look at the snowboard, there has not been much new snow in the last little while. But if we look behind the snowboard, which is designed for capturing snow and seeing how much there's been, we can actually see it is a beautiful, sunny, and snowy day in the west end of Glacier National Park. We'll head to another quick webcam, take a look at what's going on. We're back at Panorama. So a view from up the hill, we can see a beautiful sunny day there. And this one is the Canmore Clubhouse webcam. So we can see the three sisters there, just right through the trees in a beautiful, beautiful sunny day in Canmore right now, where it's about -4, -3 degrees and beautiful out. Our next guest is coming to us from Crow's Nest Pass, Alberta, and we'll be connecting with Fred Bradley.
Hi, Megan.
So, I mean, for those of that don't know you, Fred, you're a local heritage and community activist. You're a former, or maybe I should say recovering, politician. And you're also one of the organizers for the first ever Crow's Nest Spirit Festival that wraps up today. So tell us a bit about that festival and how it came to be.
Well, actually, two or three of us got together about just less than a month ago after Matthew Berry had suggested we might want to participate in International Mountain Day. But we had formed a small organizing committee, the Crow's Nest Nordic Ski Club, Crow's Nest Outdoors, the Pass Powder Keg Ski Club, Crow's Nest Conservation Group, and the Crow's Nest Heritage Initiative. And we thought, we've got a lot of mountain culture here in the Crow's Nest Pass. We got a lot of outdoor activities, got a lot of history, a lot of artistic people here. So we thought we could come up with our own festival to celebrate International Mountain Day. And we came up with the idea of Crow's Nest Mountain Spirit Festival as the concept. So we've only had less than a month to organize this. And I think we've had a very successful weekend so far.
Wonderful. And in terms of the events that you planned for the weekend, what was going on there?
Well, we started off on Saturday night or Friday night with the first night skiing at the Pass Powder Keg Ski Hill. Followed up on Saturday, we had a gear check day at the Allison Chinook cross-country ski area sponsored by the Crow's Nest Nordic Ski Club. They had hot chocolate. They had waxing benches. People had opportunities to tune up their skis and go on some small hikes. And they had a campfire with hot chocolate and homemade soup. Later that evening, we had a really exciting event that put on by Lisa Kinnair of outdoor mountain bound photography, had over 38 people participate in the night hike up to the top of the Pass Powder Keg Ski Hill to watch the Gemini meteorite shower and take nighttime photography. They also had a campfire up there and hot chocolate, so that sounded like an excellent event. Yesterday, the Crow's Nest Outdoors had a hike up on the Big Bear a mountain bike trail. We were going to do some snowshoeing down here, but it's been really warm down here. I think it's only -2 today, but it was in the +10 to +15 range over the week.
Oh, wow.
Altered some of our activities to hikes. They had a great hike. They had 15 people participate. And I think we're going to see some pictures of that later on. Also that afternoon in Bellevue, the Bellcrest community had their first Bellevue Light Festival. And they had a number of Christmas activities, Santa Claus party with the children, fire truck rides, again, outdoor campfires and hot chocolate and shared a lot of food and stories. And then they lit up the town, and they're looking at their goal is to have 1 million lights on the main street of Bellevue in the future, but this is their first attempt at. So that would sound like a great activity. And this afternoon, actually, the CPR Christmas train is arriving in Coleman. So that's sort of an added feature for International Mountain Day, and that's happening at 1:15. And then tonight we have an event at the Crow's Nest, or at the Frank Slide Interpretive Center, two guest lectures, Peter Sherrington talking about the eagle, golden eagle migration along Livingston Range, which has the world's largest recorded number of golden eagles seen from one spot. And then followed by a lecture about the buzz about wild bees by Megan Evans. So that's sort of our first attempt at the Crow's Nest Mountain Spirit Festival honoring International Mountain Day.
Well, I think it's a pretty fantastic first shot at it. For those of you that just saw the photos behind some really fun activities, people getting outside and enjoying the great outdoors. And I know that, Fred, one of the activities this weekend was to ask people what Crow's Nest Mountain Spirit meant to them. And I was wondering if there were any answers that really stuck out for you.
Well, I have a whole bunch, actually, Megan. We have a contest on, I mean, what does Crow's Nest Mountain Spirit mean to you? And we're going to, Bound for Mountain Photography is going to donate a print we're going to draw tonight at the Frank Slide Interpretive Center. So there's still chances for people to participate. But Karen Davies Wilson said, seeing the sun rise and fall every day in the beautiful mountains, especially my favorite Crow's Nest Mountain, and knowing that I'm home. Daniel Harris said, quirky things like random snow on the first week of school, and then the community we live in. I love our community, and we can all laugh a little when it snows in September. I think it's part of what makes the mountain living so amazing and unpredictable. Jordan Nathaniel Brown said, Crow's Nest Mountain Spirit to me means paradise. It's our escape from work and life to a place where time can slow down and we can enjoy each other's company in one of the most beautiful yet affordable places of the country. A truly hidden gem, which I'm glad we found. Kimberly Uhersky said, the combination of feeling of freedom and of awe when I take in the amazing view of the mountains with the pink sky in the background on my way to work in the morning and the refreshing feeling I get when I breathe deeply the mountain air. There's nothing else like it. I've got two more here. Mm-hmm. Carolee Civitries, Crow's Nest Mountain Spirit means stepping outside your front door during a rainstorm and smelling the fresh pine and sweet smells of our beautiful mountain town. It's shoveling snow so deep that the mountains can be made. It's tasting the cold, pure flavor of our crystal blue waters. It's knowing that each trail could lead to a new adventure with your family. It's years and years of unique cultures wrapped up in our five towns. It's feeling blessed each morning I wake up knowing I'm so lucky to raise both my children in this wonderful place. And then finally, one of my favorites, Crow's Nest Mountain Spirit is a testament to the enduring power of time, weather, spiritual history, and natural beauty that never ceases to amaze and inspire respect and humility to all who eyes to gaze upon what it is.
Well,
so that sort of sums up some of the comments that people put on our website contest to say, what does Crow's Nest Mountain Spirit mean to you?
Those are some fantastic answers. And I feel like that last quote just ties in to my last question for you, which is, I know that you've been a fierce supporter that the Crow's Nest Pass should become a UNESCO World Heritage Site. We saw some photos as you were reading those thoughts about Mountain Spirit, and so we can see how beautiful the area is. But what's your case? Tell us why you think that the pass should be a UNESCO World Heritage Site.
Well, it starts, I guess, with Crow's Nest Mountain being one of the iconic mountains of the. The thought is to be the Crow's Nest Pass is a unique cultural, natural, historic landscape, and there's a number of segments to that, and makes it unique in terms of UNESCO designation. They have cultural or natural. We're sort of a combination of both. The effect of man's settlement on the area over the period of years, but Crow's Nest Mountain is one of the iconic mountains of the Canadian Rockies in terms of it just stands out as no other mountain stands out, I believe. So I'm sort of a little biased there. But it was a spiritual mountain to the Blackfoot people, the Pagan people. It was one of their three Vision Quest mountains, the other two being United States, Chief Mountain, the Sweet Grass Hills. But I always had that traditional spiritual mountain aspect to our indigenous people, but it continues to be a spiritual mountain to the people who live here today. We have a rich cultural history here of settlement patterns by mankind, and it goes back to indigenous settlement that goes back over 8,000 years, actually. So there's archaeological, we have the richest number of pre-European archaeological sites in a mountain pass in Canada, we believe. And it goes back to the early settlements at Crow's Nest Lake. On the Livingston Range, there is a Vision Quest site, or not a Vision Quest site, but a quarry site, a Chert quarry site, where a chert was mined for Indian arrowheads and tools. And that goes back 2,000 or 3,000 years. And just above that is this Livingston Range flyway where Peter Sherrington has seen all these eagles and all these birds, where this large recording of the golden eagles has taken place. That's the indigenous, the European settlement. Coal mining is certainly a big part of our tradition. Rum running, prohibition. We have just opened the Alberta Provincial Police Barracks Museum, which tells about the shooting of a constable during the rum running era. And the opera Philomena was based on that. A large number, our ethnic cultural community here, probably in terms of settlement of Western Canada communities, we had over 42 nationalities settle here, and they had a great influence on the community. Number of ethnic halls, but also the tradition of the Crow's Nest Symphony Orchestra, which is the oldest amateur symphony orchestra, I think, in Canada that still is playing, performing. Same with Alberta. And then our ecology. Well, this Crow's Nest Pass is a unique transitional zone in terms of flora and fauna species. We are a transitional zone for species from British Columbia going from west to east through the pass into Alberta, and a north-south transition zone of species from southern species going north to the southernmost exposure of some species and the northernmost of others. So this transition zone is unique. So these are some of the unique history of this area. Frank Slide, for example, at the Frank Slide Interpretive Center, they monitor the movement of that mountain, the geological perspective. We have the Lewis Thrust Fault that goes through here. We have karst caves, gargantuan caverns. And then we have all this outdoor activity, which I think is showcased in some of the photos. We have some mountain bike trails that are being developed to international mountain bike standards. We have hiking trails. We have all these outdoor activities, snowshoeing, cross-country skiing, downhill skiing, snowmobiling. And we even have started ski joring here in February. So there's a lot to celebrate here about our mountain culture, but also this unique natural features, historical features, cultural features, I think can lend itself with, and I know it's going to take a lot of time to do all the research and bring down together all these facts, but I think we have a unique historical mountain, historical, natural, cultural landscape here that we need to think about and manage into the future. And part of that is, how do you manage this landscape and appreciate all the values which we have here, and our mountain culture, and how we celebrate that and how we maintain it into the future.
For sure. Well, thank you so much for sharing a bit of your corner of the world with us, Fred, and a very happy International Mountain Day to you.
Well, thank you very much, and the same to you. And having watched what the other participants put together, I'm sure next year we will have some interesting videos and other aspects of our mountain culture life, which we celebrate here, to share with you and the International Mountain Day Network. And thank you very much for having us participate today. Thank you, Megan.
Oh, thank you so much, Fred. And if you are in the Crow's Nest Pass area, you can head to their Birds and Bees lecture at 7 o'clock that Fred had mentioned. That's at the Frank Slide Interpretive Center. And that's where guest speakers Peter Sherrington and Megan Evans will be talking about the migration of golden eagles, but also wild bees, hence the birds and the bees. There have been a lot of activities for International Mountain Day around Canada, around the world, and the Canadian Mountain Network has been hosting a bunch themselves. And earlier this week, on December 6th, there was a panel discussion ranging on a variety of issues related to mountain ranges. And here's a taste of some of the activities that were happening at the University of Alberta.
So where I'm starting with this initiative is a look at contaminants in berries. And there's a number of berries that are important to First Nations peoples here in Alberta, and also beavers. And so beavers have kind of a special place in my heart for reasons that I will explain. But I'm thinking there's an opportunity here to also use beavers as a kind of a natural biomonitor of ecosystem health.
But in the last decade, there's a new technology that's come along. You've probably heard of trail cameras. And these are just cameras that are about the size of a regular camera that's put out in the field, and it is able then to take a picture of these animals when they pass in front of the camera, and that has become the new standard, or is becoming the new standard for monitoring many of these large mammals, mid and large mammals. And that's what I'm going to talk about today, is just some of the methods that are used for tracking these key species.
So since we've begun, we've had about 14 camps. So we include the language, we include having elders there, we include having researchers there, we have people coming in and dissecting fish and explaining what's going on with our fish, because we do have researchers from, I think, three different universities. We were part of the tracking change that U of A is doing, so I got to go to Thailand as a part of my job, which was amazing, and I got to learn about the water in the Mackenzie River Basin. And so this program kind of does a lot of different amazing things and has a lot of different, we built a lot of really amazing relationships with different schools and different people and different researchers.
A bit of a taste of some of the events for International Mountain Day and the festivities this past week. And right now, if you're in Calgary, right now there's an activity around bison reintroduction, celebrating the introduction of bison to Banff National Park. That's happening at the John Dutton Theatre at the Calgary Central Library. And right after this this live stream, actually starting in the next few minutes, it's going to be a presentation called Living with Wildlife. It's going to be a screening of the film as well as a filmmaker Q&A, and that's also at the John Dutton Theatre. And on the topic of bison, and also on the topic of celebrating mountains year-round, it's not just the International Mountain Day live stream that the Canadian Mountain Network does. There's also a Canadian Mountain podcast. And I wanted to share a little piece with you of the most recent podcast that's just gone up, and it's looking at the reintroduction of bison to Banff National Park. This is, you'll see me interviewing William Snow as well as Marie-Ève Marchand from Bison Belong, and they're talking about the effects of bringing bison Banff to National Park. Take a look.
Buffalo have been in the Bow Valley for many years. Going back, there have been remains found within Banff National Park going back at least 10,000 years. And a lot of that history is really not known, and I think that there's more publications and more research being done on bison in different areas, and that's good. And we need to really take a second look at all of the history of wildlife within important corridors like the Bow Valley.
We're bringing them back to be wild, to be free, not to be fenced anymore. And that's the first time in over 140 years that this time in Banff, within a few months, they will be roaming around the valleys of the Pender.
Wow.
Well, I think this is part of a process that's been underway for a number of years. This is not the first time that Parks has tried to bring buffalo into the parks, and those efforts previously did not involve a lot of First Nations or other groups in order to try and facilitate that. And so this time around, in this cycle of trying to reintroduce bison into the national parks, we began talking early on with Parks, and Parks, I think, reached out to a lot of different groups to get their take on how this should be done. And I think one of the reasons why it should be done is because of all of the functions that buffalo perform on landscapes, all of the biodiversity that buffaloes bring with them being on part of the landscape. Wes Olson talks a lot about this in his work, all of the different types of insects, all of the different other ungulates, fish species, birds that naturally come into areas where bison are normally habitating. And so I think for all of those kind of reasons, for strengthening biodiversity. I think that's a really important part of why it's done. The other why as to why it's done is also cultural. Indigenous people have regarded the bison as a very important part of the culture. Bison skulls are still used today in many of the important ceremonies. And because of that, the bison has always had a special place, not only within the culture, but as a religious symbol for many indigenous nations. And so for that reason, and for all of the other intangibles that are associated with buffalo, I think that's another reason why it gained support to bring bison back to the landscape, Banff National Park.
It's a taste of the Canadian Mountain Podcast, those last shots there. Yes, the bison were airlifted into Banff National Park almost a year ago, this past February. And if you want to find out more about the reintroduction of bison to Banff National Park, or the importance of bison in that region, or even if you just want to see inside that teepee that you saw the shot of, you can find it all on the latest podcast episode of the Canadian Mountain Podcast. And you can find that all at canadianmountainnetwork.ca. And that wraps up our International Mountain Day live stream. Thank you so much for joining me today. I'm Meg Wilcox from the University of Alberta at Edmonton. And if you want any more information on International Mountain Day, you can always head to internationalmountainday.ca. Don't forget, if you're going to post anything online, use the hashtag MountainsMatterCA.
Special thanks to our participants, to Meg Wilcox, our host, and to the University of Alberta and the Faculty of Science for supporting this podcast.